Blog Talk Radio. Jerry, how are you, dude?
I'm doing pretty good, dude. How are you doing?
I'm good, dude. Let's refer to each other as dudes for the rest of the show.
Okay, sounds good to me.
It'll be like our unofficial tribute to Sam Elliott in The Big Lebowski.
There you go. I'm all for that. That's a good thing.
Thank you all for joining us. Tonight we have a great big show for you, a roundtable between myself, Jerry, and Chris about the latest movie news and headlines. Probably even talk a little TV, too, since the Emmys are tonight.
That'd be cool. That'd be great.
Which is the only reason why I care anything about the Emmys tonight is because Al Pacino's going to win. Thank you.
Okay, is it really? I mean, you're not interested in any of the shows that are up, or?
Conversation closed. Al Pacino. That's it.
Okay, all right. I just thought, I mean, we're living in a great age of television.
I know, we do. I know. I was on the front cover of the paper giving my Emmy picks today.
Cool.
And mine were different from everyone else's, which goes to show, I don't know, we'll know late tonight, but either I'm a genius or I know nothing about television. I'm a movie guy, you know.
Right.
But, you know, the shows that I watch typically don't, I don't know about that. I watch lots of HBO stuff. They're always the most dominated network.
But we're living in a period of great broadcast television. I mean, great sitcoms like Parks and Recreation, The Office, 30 Rock, Modern Family. And even some really good dramas are, you know, like Lost, which ended, and there are new ones that are coming this year that seem good. I mean, I think actually the television is really good. I'm not saying it's better than movies or vice versa. I'm just saying there's a lot of great radio out there.
I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
You also have to take into account the temperament of the Emmy voters that tend to award the same things over and over again, I think, because I usually watch at least part of them every year. I mean, they're the kind of people that will nominate Tony Shalhoub for Monk 12 times and give him 8 of those. You know, they're pretty predictable for the most part. So I just voted Mad Men and Glee, like, down the line. But Pacino is up against Jeff Bridges, Ian McKellen, like a lot of great actors. Dennis Quaid. I think the only one that has a shot at rivaling Pacino is Dennis Quaid, just because he's not honored that often. And
right.
It's a high-profile role, but it's kind of a blah film.
Right. Oh, it is a blah film. I'm not going to lie to you. It's.
Yeah, I wasn't really taken by it. But yeah, that's the only reason why I care, really.
Right.
They're not going to give anything to True Blood. They've never given anything to Curb Your Enthusiasm.
No, they I don't think they ever gave anything. They never gave anything to The Wire when the one time The Wire was nominated.
Right. And has there ever been a funnier show than Curb Your Enthusiasm? Has there ever been a braver show than The Wire? You know.
It's not like all award shows. It really doesn't mean much at the end of the day. It really doesn't. But. No, but there is, regardless of how I feel about the award show, I just do think there's a lot of great TV out there right now. There are two great sitcoms coming back on HBO at the end of September, Bored to Death and Eastbound and Down. I'm really excited about those. So, all right, I got this conversation off track, so I'm going to shut up now.
No. We just took care of our TV conversation at the top of the show.
Okay, cool.
That's good. Tonight we have the number one, the star of the number one movie in America, The Last Exorcism. But that comes with a little caveat here, because it's number one as of right now. Have you read this stuff?
Yeah. Takers is. I have not seen Takers, and I would have loved to have seen Takers when it was originally supposed to come out earlier this year.
Yeah, it's like the second in Matt Dillon's Armored Car series.
Yeah.
I don't know what the hell he's doing.
No, was advertised last year, though, this movie. I mean, they've been advertising it forever.
Yeah, it might be a studio thing. I think it's, I forget which studio it is. Is it Columbia?
I thought it was Columbia Sony or something like that, yeah.
Yeah,
or Screen Gems, which whoever owns that.
Yeah, who knows what corporation owns that. But they're neck and neck right now. The estimates came out with The Last Exorcist at $21.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
And right behind it at $21.1 million is Takers. So they are probably less than $100,000 apart. So Sony or Screen Gems, whatever, I see them twittering and they're saying, "We're so close to number one, guys. Rally together and watch the movie tonight."
Yeah,
so
mm-hmm, yeah.
There's no telling. And I guess there's power in that number one number. I mean, they can put it on the ads, the number one movie in America. You know,
it's a
big selling point. Right.
Yeah.
We were number one for a week.
We were number one for 24 hours.
Remember that 6 o'clock hour that Sunday night when we were number one? That was beautiful.
Yeah, no, but here's the thing about Takers. I haven't seen it. I went to go see The Last Exorcism instead, but Takers was supposed to come out earlier this year. I mean, it's been pushed back and pushed back, and supposedly some of the cast members were not happy with the film. They saw it and they didn't like it. So, but it's obviously one of those genres that, and I think just the combination, the cast and everything, people are very, there are people very excited about some of the actors in the movie, and I can't blame
right.
them. I understand.
Right. I mean, I haven't seen it. You haven't seen it, so we don't know about it yet. But
yeah,
I'll tell you what I did see yesterday, and then we'll get to our interview.
Mm-hmm.
I saw, this was surprising. I was going to take my brother out to the movies last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to take my brother out to the kinds of movies that I always take my brother out to, the kind that feature hundreds of people getting slaughtered senselessly.
Mm-hmm.
So, the prime choice there is The Expendables.
Oh, not Eat, Pray, Love? Okay.
No. We're the only ones that would die watching that. So then my mom says, "I want to see that." My mother, like, rarely goes to the movies. So we take my mom to The Expendables. I was shocked that she was interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sat through it. Mom's whole take on it was when she got out, "I'm exhausted." And that was very loud. Me, you know, I got what I expected, but there's a couple of interesting things about it. I mean, that movie's a success and they're talking sequel now, and Stallone says that he wants Bruce Willis to play the super villain in the sequel. It's a couple of observations I have about it. I genuinely like Rambo. I genuinely think Rambo is the great kick-ass movie of last year.
Mm-hmm.
Replaced this year by, ironically enough, Kick-Ass.
Yeah.
But The Expendables was, you know, it's tricky because you have an ensemble thing. I could tell that as he cast the actors, according to the level of popularity of each actor, he probably had to rewrite the parts to fit them.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know, because
yeah.
Jason Statham is probably the second biggest American star besides Stallone, so he had to write that as like the sidekick, the major sidekick. And then Mickey Rourke's in it, so he gives Mickey Rourke a meaty monologue, since Mickey Rourke's obviously a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, this monologue that Mickey Rourke has in this movie, which is played very emotionally, very genuinely, it feels like, man, it belongs in a different movie.
Yeah, all the scenes where he starts talking, I mean, you're like, wait, is this another movie? I mean, because it's like, dude, what are you talking about?
I mean, it's like performing Shakespeare in the middle of She's Out of My League or something. You know, it doesn't fit. It's a great moment, but it's just odd. And then, you know, I think he shoots too many close-ups. I appreciate the fact that he doesn't shoot shaky cam action. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't tell what's going on necessarily.
Right.
But I think there's too many close-ups. And one part where that really bothered me was the Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis scene. Because I don't even think it's established that Bruce Willis is in the same room as Arnold Schwarzenegger. Bruce Willis might as well be in a completely different room on a different day. The way that movie shot. It's just shot in close-up.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that's the film's money shot, though. I really do think that's the...
I'm talking about the whole scene. I'm talking
about... Yeah, no, I know. I realize that, but I mean...
How the scene plays.
Yeah. Well, that's funny. I didn't even think about that, but I know what you're talking about, though, yeah.
Like, you never see Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger in the same frame.
Well, that's...
That's
interesting.
You do see one shot of he and Stallone in the same frame.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all three of them are shot in these close-ups, and the scene doesn't have room to breathe. It's only like a 4-minute scene, but
Do you think it was Planet Hollywood? Like someone got ripped off of the Planet Hollywood money? Because that's all I could think of while watching them. Oh my God, it's the Planet Hollywood guys. Oh my God.
I know it is, but they're all three obviously did the scene together. They came in at 4 o'clock on a Sunday morning and did it for two
mm-hmm.
hours. As has been described in the press. The other thing is the fight scene between Dolph Lundgren and Jet Li. You can't appreciate how balletic Jet Li is in that fight.
Mm-hmm.
I missed that because Jet Li. I mean, watch any of his other movies, and he's a nimble guy.
Yeah, no, he is. It's interesting. That's a very good observation about Jet Li's character in the film. You don't get to see the usual Jet Li theatrics
yeah.
and everything. That's definitely put on the back burner.
Yeah. Did you see The Last Exorcism this week?
Yes, I did. I actually thought
okay.
it was pretty cool.
You did?
Yeah, because I mean, it's not my kind of thing. And from the trailer is very. I think the trailer is incredibly misleading, but. I actually thought it was pretty interesting, and that's mainly, I think, to the lead actor's performance.
And the because they say it's you I don't want you to give away anything, but
no,
they do talk about the ending of the movie. I mean, they don't detail what it is in reviews and things,
mm-hmm.
but they kind of in a way to say it's not necessarily what you expect it to be. There's something different at play here.
No, there's definitely something different at play, but what I liked about the film was our guest performance is really the anchor of the movie. Forget everything else. It's just not what I expected from the title, from everyone associated with the film. It's just nothing that I expected.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really cool. Patrick Fabian really just gives this like knockout performance. That really I know a lot of people like the audience's cinema score gave it a D.
The audiences did, huh?
Yeah. And this reminds me of the public, when the Blair Witch Project went wide, a lot of people hated it because it wasn't what they thought the movie would be. They weren't used to
right.
this kind of film. And I have a feeling that's probably what happened here. But I like the way the film unfolded. I really thought that, I didn't really read that much about it before seeing it, so... I got to say, I was pleasantly surprised. I was interested, let's put it like this, I was interested to see what happens next,
mm-hmm.
you know, each turn.
Well, that's good. That's
yeah.
good. I have not checked it out.
Yeah.
I did not take my mother to see Last Exorcism.
No, yeah, I think you got the Expendables. You ain't getting the Last Exorcism in there, too. So forget it.
That was not on her list. But that's a perfect build-up to the interview. Patrick Fabian, the star of The Last Exorcism, is here with us tonight. And you know where I know him from before this movie is Big Love. He had a recurring character on Big Love.
That makes a lot of sense now because I mean there would be similarities with that character and that show because it is that kind of performance. There's no doubt about
yeah.
that.
And he of course plays the exorcist Cotton Marcus in The Last Exorcism. And here is our conversation with him, the star of the number one movie in America. As of right this minute. here's Patrick.
Exorcism is alive and well. The Bible is filled with demons. If you believe in God, you have to believe in the devil.
We're looking for the Sweetser farm.
You want to make a U-turn, and then I want you to go back where you came from.
Jeez, go, go!
Seems like the end of the road.
Mr. Sweetser?
How you doing?
Not in Market.
My wife died 2 years ago. It's quite a shock for Nell. Were you very close?
She was my best friend.
Somehow, the devil cut in her.
Nell, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good, nothing to be nervous about.
What is it? It's coming to my skin. Please help. Get it out of my head.
Let him come now.
Running around panting a lot, and so when I saw the finished product, you know, initially I wanted to see it beforehand, but Eli Roth and Daniel Stamm, the director, they said, look, I can give you a DVD of this, you can watch it at home, or we could get an office, he said, but trust me, you're going to want to see it with an audience, and I'm so glad I waited. It was a gift that Eli and Daniel gave me to sit down there in the amphitheater and watch a bunch of people who were interested in seeing Eli Roth's produced latest film and watch it unfold, because, of course, when you're in a film, you know, for four or five weeks, you think the film is, you know, like Gone with the Wind. It's 18 hours long, and most of it's about you. And the reality is, you know, the director has a really good idea of what he's painting, and Daniel has created a taut, scary, totally watchable, fun film with characters that you care about. It's unlike any other horror film I've seen, and watching the audience reaction was great. They laughed. There was humor in the film that it was unexpected for me. And then when it got time and got down to business to try creating, you know, imagery and things that would put chills in people and make them look over their shoulder when they leave the theater, that started happening. You know, the excitement of watching it, everybody's sort of chattering. And then as the film progresses, it gets to that wonderful, you can hear people breathing during the last third, you know, paying attention. And, you know, and that's the creep you're looking for. At least that's what I'm looking for in a horror film.
Absolutely. And I find that horror films and comedies, they're both similar in that they thrive on audience reaction like no other genre. So that's really an exciting thing that you got to see it with an audience.
Yeah, it was, especially the first time out. And I, you know, and just that whole, it is a communal thing. I mean, you can, you know, I grew up watching horror films in the panel basement in my parents' house in, you know, Pennsylvania. And when you're 14 and 15, you know, the Sentinel and Rosemary's Baby will do the trick on you by yourself. There's no doubt about it. But the dark theater is a place that we, you know, communally show up to, like, look at our fears. And a horror movie is that great collective. I mean, that's like, get around the campfire and let's tell a story. Yeah, I love that.
I'm curious, though, when you watch it with an audience, because the actual process of doing it, I don't know if you can feel whether it's working in terms of being scary, of being effectively scary. So were you surprised by how effective it was when you saw the finished product?
In both ways, both in its humor and humanity and both in the scare factor. You know, the stuff that you think is funny or good when you're actually doing it, usually doesn't end up there. And the stuff that is a little more pedestrian in your mind, or maybe a throwaway, which, I, by the way, is a little more honest in your acting. You know what I mean? If you're conscious of what you're doing, I think a lot of times you get a worse performance. But Daniel's technique of doing multiple takes and rehashing stuff, we would do 20 to 30 takes on scenes, you know, and it would break you down and wear you down to the point where you are reacting, you know, and you're not trying to show anything. And those moments all of a sudden have pathos. They have humanity, and the audience recognizes that. The audience is not dumb. They know what's true and what's funny like that. And so I was caught by surprise by some of the things that I didn't think were really funny at the time, but when you build it together and edit it together properly, like Shilpa, our editor, did, it gets a great reaction. In the same respect, stuff that creeped me out, some of it lines up with what I think the audience gets creeped out about. But, you know, I forget, you know, being the actor, you're sort of myopic looking at it. And as a director, that's why you need them. He's looking at the whole picture. So there's certain things that I found scary that, in the end, didn't even make it onto the screen. But the stuff that made it onto the screen, all of a sudden, the audience is going, huh, and they're collectively jumping up in their seats. And I'm like, oh, right, that's scary.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this film is shot in kind of a documentary style, correct?
Yes, the whole the premise is that, you know, I'm Cotton Marcus, I'm a reverend, and I've made my life and my career. I was a child preacher, it's been like the family business, and I've been an exorcist as well, and I've reached sort of a come to Jesus moment, pardon the pun, and I've decided that, you know, what I've been doing is basically has been a fraud and a charlatan. So I've hired a film crew to follow me to, i.e. the last exorcism, to film it, to show the world what a fraud it is. Because I don't want children to get hurt anymore, and I'm having my own guilty conscience. So I'm using the film as a way to sort of make amends and to sort of hang up my cross all at the same time. You know, one last swan song, one more time at the dance floor.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we get down to the farm, and we encounter something. I encounter something that I'm not sure how to deal with. And doing it documentary style, I have to say Zoltan Hanti is a cinematographer, and the woman who plays the documentarian, Iris Barr, you know, we were an acting troupe of ourselves because everything I say to the camera, and there's an awful lot of me speaking directly to the camera, I'm speaking to those two. And so they act very much as my scene partner, but they're silent for the most of it. You know, the way it got edited down, you know, I don't think you see Zoltan at all, and you see Iris just for a couple of minutes in the film. But their presence is certainly felt because they became my confidants throughout the whole thing. And after the first day or two of acting like that, you know, we got real used to it. It just became hat in hand, talking to the cameraman, talking directly to the lens, and talking to Iris. So that's just the way that the audience gets to discover the story. And that's why I think Daniel shot such a cool film, because you get comfortable with me talking to the camera, I believe, in the first bit of the film. And then it's like the audience is invited to come sit in the car with us. And so Zoltan's cinematography allows us to sort of experience the rest of the story just like I do. And not in that sort of 14-year-old, you know, I've had my first line of cocaine jerky kind of motion, but rather in, he's a filmmaker who's, you stay in school, don't do drugs, by the way. but you know what I mean? But when he handles it as a cameraman, we're not pretending that it's somebody sneakily trying to get something. The premise is, he's a cameraman, he's here, and the camera gets acknowledged, so consequently, he gets to lay in and frame us up and find out what the story is. You know, what I found interesting watching the film was, what I thought we were being discovered on frame, of course, he's the cameraman, and he's not necessarily interested in every single thing I have to say. So the camera drifts off, and you start to get other information that the camera picks up while the scene is continuing off screen a little bit. So it's that wonderful sensation of wanting to control the camera a bit as an audience member, or wanting to look around the edge of the frame. And I think Daniel and Zoltan and Shilpa, between the three of them, really create that sense of, you get enough satisfaction of knowing where you are, but you also get that little... That inch of like, but I need to know what's over there aspect. And it really ratchets up the tension. You know, Daniel does it the old-fashioned way. Just CGI, no crazy tricks other than just good filmmaking with shadow, light, mood, that sort of thing.
Well, and it really encourages the audience to be a participant in the movie, which I think is wonderful and unique these days.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It does. It's like we ask you to get in the car with us. For the first third of the film, it's like this really nice this ride, and we're seeing all the wonderful scenery. And then the second third of the film, all of a sudden, the audience is like, "Hey, why is the car going? Why is the car going sideways?" And the driver's like, "What do you mean it's going sideways?" And the audience member goes, "No, it really is going sideways." And then the car's upside down. And by the final third of the film, and the audience member's like, "Get me out of the car!" And you know, at that point, the filmmaker's like, "No, you can't get out of the car." So that's the thrill ride that comes in my mind.
Maybe we could ask this guy.
Stopping.
Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, afternoon.
You guys making a movie?
A documentary, actually. How's it going?
Good. I like documentaries.
Okay.
Oh, good. We're looking for the Sweetser Farm.
Who's
us?
In there?
Reverend Cotton Marcus.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. The Sweetser Farm, please.
Yes.
I'm Reese. This is Daniel.
Hey.
Sorry, we're just a little behind schedule, so.
No, no problem.
The Sweetser Farm, please.
Right. We're going the wrong direction. You want to make a U-turn, actually.
Okay.
You want to take this road, go straight.
Uh-huh.
You see things you already seen before, keep on growing. You're going to hit the highway. Okay? And then I want you to go back where you came from.
Are you kidding?
No, no.
Gotcha. Thank you. Sorry about that.
What?
Jeez.
Whoa.
So tell me how this project came about for you.
First of all, Eli Roth found the script a while ago, and I can't thank him enough. Without Eli Roth looking at it, it doesn't get done. You know, he's shown an interest in it, and all the right things opened up. I got to go into Lauren Bass Casting's office here in Los Angeles, and I was asked to come in and do some improv with the girl who eventually had the role, Ashley Bell. And we did some improv about trying to be a preacher, convincing her to sort of do things, and I came back for another audition where I had to come up with my own sermon, and then I got the role. And from there, we went, and I just want to make sure it gets said that, you know, Ashley Bell is so good, so convincing as the girl who may or may not be possessed. I'm not going to say anything. She's so good, and she makes my job so easy because, let's face it, if you're in an exorcism movie and the girl who's possessed isn't convincing, you don't have a movie. And the whole thing, I think, lives and dies on her performance. Makes everybody more realistic, and I can't thank her enough as being a scene partner. You know, this is her first big film, and, man, she really came to play. You know what I'm saying?
Wow. You shot this in, you said, what, 4 or 5 weeks?
Yeah, 4 or 5 weeks, 6 days a week. I think it was a 4.5 week shoot. 6 days a week, 12 hours a day down in Louisiana. Hot, humid, bugs, alligators, swamp rats. We were down in the lower Ninth Ward where Hurricane Katrina had, you know, devastated it. So we went past the devastation, and we were like the last farm on the right. And it's this old plantation from like the 1860s, you know, it was a sugar mill at one point, it was all these different things, and there's rundown and the barns. I mean, everything you see in the film is very authentic in its sense of isolation and then the implements of destruction that are put on the wall and all that stuff. So it really set a great mood. And the night shoots especially, you know, the cicadas, the crickets would be out there going, you know, just deafening. No, I'm just going to say, really cool now. I love the fact that I'm painting it like this romantic. Oh, it's so nice. It was so wonderful. If I recall, I was bitching nonstop about wearing a linen suit in 110-degree heat. Not, you know, you never peed all day and you drank all day because you were so dehydrated. So I like it. Waxing romantic about, ah, the good old days in New Orleans, you know.
So when this opens, will you be going to some theaters to watch it opening weekend?
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah, I mean, we're having the red carpet premiere is in Los Angeles on the 24th at the Arclight Theater. And that's going to be great. You know, I get to have family and friends and whatnot see, but I'm absolutely going to be, you know, I'm so excited and so lucky. I get to be that guy wearing the baseball cap and going in the back row and watching people come in on opening weekend who said, you know, because there's a lot of chatter on the internet, there's a lot of chatter, the reviews have been really good and positive so far, but you don't know really. I mean, because the people who have come to see it so far have been people who specifically want to come see, you know, a horror film.
Yeah.
And so they like what they see, and that's great, but I want to see if that can translate, you know, across the country in a good way. I think it will, because I think, you know, it's PG-13 for a reason. It is not a hack and slash. It is not a body count movie. It is not a, you know, an arrow in your eye kind of movie sort of thing. And I say that not to say that it's not scary, because it is scary. But it's got a little bit more than that, I think. And you will get your thrills. You will definitely get your thrills. But Freddy's not coming out of anywhere. You know what I'm saying? It's not that movie. And those movies are great. And they live there. And but I think this is unique. I think Daniel has, you know, put his stamp on a new way of telling an old tale. Zoltan Hanti, as a cinematographer, I think has raised the bar and the standard of what it means to be handheld. I mean, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like one of those movies. It looks like it could become a phenomenon. I mean, when I saw the trailer, it looked like it definitely could translate into becoming one of those event movies.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, Lionsgate hopes so, and so do I, as a matter of fact, because I think the film. You know, I was saying this to somebody else the other day. They're asking me, they're like, oh, yeah, you're promoting the film, and, you know, but what do you really think about it? And I thought that's a fair question, because sometimes you end up, you know, encouraging people to go see things that really aren't that good. I try not to, but I've certainly been in my share of poop, you know, for lack of a better word, and this is not bad. This is not a suck film. This is not a bad film. This is a good film. It's a good, scary film, and it's, you know, come on, my mother's going to it.
Before I let you go, excuse me, I really want to ask you about your work on Big Love, because that's one of my favorite shows ever. Tell me the experience of being part of that family there.
Well, part of that is great. I mean, HBO has got a great show there. It's got a cast, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again. You know, the fish stinks from the head down, and Bill Paxton is a great stand-up guy. He's everything you'd want him to be if you met him in real life, and I've had the opportunity to do so and work with him. You know, him and Gene Triplehorn and that whole cast, they just come to work prepared, ready to go, enthusiastic, with questions and answers about their characters. You know, Will and Mark, the producers, they run the show like a family. And it's great going to work with, you know, it's great to play tennis with people who are better than you. That's how you get better. You know, I loved working with scenes with Gene and Bill, and I think they made me a better actor. You know, they wrote better stuff for me because of it, and they were encouraging. And it's wonderful to be a part of a show that, like you said, I felt the same way. I loved the show before I even got a chance to be on it, and I was thrilled every week to watch it and was surprised, you know, I was surprised to watch myself walk through that world. Matter of fact, the first day of work, you know, I watched the first two seasons back-to-back just sort of like rev up for it, and I show up on set. And I'm like, hey, hi, oh, hi, I'm saying hello to all the characters because I just lived with them for, like, you know, 4 days, and God bless them, they were all sort of looking at me like, who the fuck is this kid? You know, I was like, that's such a rookie mistake, but I was so thrilled to be working and being a part of it. And, you know, they're in season 5 right now, and I'm hoping to get a couple more episodes before they wrap up this season. But they're very close to the vest when it comes to what their storylines are. So if you know anybody, take a call for me. How about?
So are they're in the writing stages now, or are they actually shooting the next season?
They're up and shooting right now, yeah. So it remains to be seen whether Ted and Cindy are going to make an appearance again.
Well, I hope you do. I love you in the show.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. You know what? It's as I said before. They're like, oh, are you like this born again Mormon like thing? I said, no. I'm your traditional American Mormon. It's money first, Jesus second. So it's all.
And you have a film coming up, the Last of the Astronauts, is it?
Land of the Astronauts, an independent film with David Arquette. I got a couple of fun scenes with him. Very sort of trippy, hallucinatory movie. I don't know what stage that is in other than post-production. I haven't been able to get a whole lot of word out of that, but I look forward to seeing that coming out. And I also have another show on Nickelodeon Teen Network. I'm playing a movie star dad on a show called Gigantic. And that's October 8th.
On Nickelodeon.
On Nickelodeon Teen, or Teen Nick, as they call it.
Okay.
PatrickFabian.com. You can see all the goings on.
Whoa! What is she doing here? What's she doing here?
No, she hasn't said a word. Now, can you hear me? She hasn't responded to anything I've said so far.
Is her dad?
I have no idea. That's why I called.
And you don't know.
I woke up. She was standing here. Now. I'm not getting any answer.
Okay, it's gonna be okay, honey. Now. Oh, oh God.
Now we need to get her to a hospital.
All right, that's Patrick Fabian, star of The Last Exorcism. I love that he's gone from The Last Exorcism to something on Nickelodeon Teen Network.
Gotta love it.
That's great. That's a great life, the life of an actor. Yeah, so check it out. Everybody check it out tonight if you want it to retain its number one spot.
We'll start paraphrasing Eli Roth now. He did that earlier on Twitter, I think, or on Facebook.
Oh, did he really?
Oh, yeah.
I bet. Yeah, it's neck and neck, man. That's something else. Mm-hmm. Tonight we're going to be premiering 3 bits of film scores from 3 new CD soundtracks. Mm-hmm. And you can purchase all 3 of these on the show page there. They're all set up so that if you click on the cover, it goes to Amazon where you can purchase them. Our first selection, and then we'll bring on Chris for our movie news roundtable, is from composer John Debney, and it is the score from Predators. So here's a little taste of that score for you. John Debney's main theme for Predators. It's available in stores now and here on our website. Speaking of Predators, our co-host Chris, who was recently featured on To Catch a Predator, is here.
Nice. Hey, by the way, congratulations, Chris.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, thank you for congratulating me on having a child at the very same minute.
I know. You have to forgive me. I didn't realize we were going. Amy was going to go there. You know,
Wait a minute. Now what?
Right. I assume he was saying congratulations on my baby. I was saying it's ironic that he does that in the same minute that you're calling me a pedophile. Hey, that music. Wow, to call that reminiscent of the original score is.
Well, it's actually noted on the soundtrack that this contains the original theme. Did your wife give birth?
Oh, no. We did find out that it's a girl, though. So.
Oh, okay. All right. It's way early.
Yeah, no, that might be, I think, what Jerry's talking about.
Yeah, I was talking about that because I hadn't talked to Chris since, you know.
All right.
Yeah.
I felt so bad. I was like, God, I'm
oh,
a terrible
God,
Fred.
God. Yeah. All right. Can we move on, please?
By the way, I still have not knocked up a woman. I just, I'm still stuck.
Yeah. Still trying with men, huh?
Okay. So you're funny. Our featured show. This week is our Texas Chainsaw Massacre tribute from 3 years ago to tie in with the Last Exorcism show tonight. It's the closest I could get to it.
Okay.
And, of course, our Cameron interview last week. Chris, did you listen to that last week?
Yes, I did. Very, very nice. Very, very good. Very, very impressive and very happy for the show. I keep telling people, like, hey, you know, we had James Cameron on. People are like, yeah, James Cameron? Like James Cameron?
Well, we've gotten a lot of, emails and stuff, and we're getting comments every day on that show on our Blog Talk Radio page from one person that keeps saying, worst movie maker ever, and I keep deleting them. So if anyone wants to leave us a nice message on that show comment area, please do. But,
can I address that real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's just something I notice with a lot of famous people, famous successful people. There's a lot of jealousy out there, and that's all that is. That's just jealousy. I'm sorry, pure and simple. I mean, I saw that too, the original comment, the first one, and I noticed it was gone 5 minutes later. But
yeah.
But I'm really fed up with this. If it's not the, you know, this is the second time we've had this with a filmmaker. The first time, of course, was for Polanski, where it ranged from we got the pedophile comments to the blatantly anti-Semitic comments. And
speaking of To Catch a Predator.
Yeah, I'm sorry about, you know, I'm sorry to keep harking back to that within 10 minutes. But I really think it's jealousy here. I notice this with a lot of famous people. People don't like someone, and it's mainly because they're jealous. I'm sorry. And I just don't have any patience or time for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clearly. Go
ahead. I was going to say, I definitely agree with you about Cameron. I don't know. Some of the hatred might be warranted in Polanski's case, but...
Polanski, yeah. But, I mean, it reminds me, this with Cameron especially, it's just like, God, you people are making so... You know, obviously you're jealous of him. I mean,
but Polanski has nothing to do with the work. You know,
right.
It has nothing to do with the actual films.
Absolutely right.
With Cameron, they're calling him the worst movie maker ever because he's one of the most successful in history. And I'm sorry, there are worse filmmakers. And if you think that Cameron's the worst filmmaker ever, you obviously don't know anything about movies. Nothing.
Right.
Now, there are politics involved with James Cameron, too, and I'm kind of thankful for that because our show was linked on a really popular conservative website bashing Cameron, which I don't care if where it ends up.
Oh,
they
yeah.
They just put it on their website, and it gave us a lot of hits for that interview. So thank you, conservative website.
Yeah, thanks,
website.
Thanks, Red State guys. Thank you.
Anyway, okay, here's some big movie news this week. In case any of us care about this. Mission Impossible 4. Paramount is rebooting the Mission Impossible franchise with the fourth installment. Here are some things that have occurred in the development of that. Mm-hmm. Tom Cruise, I guess, is definitely in because it was questionable depending upon how Night and Day performed. It seemed to be that week, but he's definitely in as Ethan Hunt still. Brad Bird is the director, which I don't know how I feel about that. But the exciting news is that Jeremy Renner has just been cast as the partner of Tom Cruise, which can be a recurring character in future installments. And they're saying when they say reboot, they're really rethinking the whole series. This isn't a continuation of anything that went before it. It might not even be called Mission Impossible 4. The working title right now is Ares.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Isn't it, when you go back and watch the original Mission Impossible, Brian De Palma really brought a lot to that. And as much as I thought the third one was a good movie, I don't feel like any of the other directors have brought anything to the series the way that he did.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is a decent movie, but it doesn't really stand out. I mean, it's not memorable or anything like that. It's well made, but well crafted, but there's nothing memorable about it. There's, you know, more than one memorable moment in the original movie. And if they can't do that, then they should just stop trying, because I don't think it's going to be as successful.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Brad Bird can do that.
Love that original concept that Tom Cruise had. Every Mission Impossible will have a new director, which he only had that notion after De Palma turned down the second one.
Yeah.
Apparently De Palma was offered the second one and turned it down. He said one Mission Impossible is enough. But every director will bring his own flavor. Now, you need to use flavorful directors in that case. You know? You need to use directors that can really bring it given that material. De Palma was perfect. Who else would be perfect? Brad Bird doesn't scream perfect to me, but who would you have in mind?
Well, definitely not James Cameron. He's the worst director ever.
Yeah, I mean, he's horrible. I mean, he has his track records lousy. I mean...
Yeah, exactly.
You know what would be interesting to give it, speaking of Jeremy Renner, to give it to somebody like Catherine Bigelow.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's
what
this kind of series needs, is a different energy given to it. The first one had an energy, and it had that thriller energy. You know, it was an action movie, but it had a thriller edge to it. The second one was an action movie that had a retarded edge to it. And the third one was just an action movie. It didn't have any edge whatsoever to it. This new one, it needs an edge. The movie has an action movie without an edge is just an action movie. I think that's obvious. So I think I would go with Catherine Bigelow. I think she needs to get back to making movies with balls, ironically.
Jerry, you have any opinion?
I've never really cared for this series. I go watch them, but I got to be honest with them. None of them really stand out to me. I got to be honest.
Are you in agreement that even though you don't like the series, the first one is probably the superior of the three that have come out?
I actually got to tell you, the third one is probably my favorite, and John Woo is probably one of my all-time favorite directors, but I just thought that movie gets lost halfway through. That movie just runs out of steam, but the De Palma one, I just remember people saying how complicated it was, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I like the third one just because there's something very simple and bare bones about it, but I've just never, I got to be honest with you, it's just not something that, none of the movies really are something I really remember past their, you know, viewing dates. I think Catherine Bigelow, sure, so you can give it a hand. I don't think Brad Bird is a bad choice. I think it's an interesting choice. I'm just very curious to see what he has in store, given his, you know, his background. What is it he thinks?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a very interesting, and it's not an odd choice for a live action.
Yeah,
film.
It's definitely not an obvious choice.
No, it's not.
As De Palma was. I mean, you knew that De Palma was Taylor fit for it when he was announced for it.
Mm-hmm. But it's just not something that really, the series, I mean, I'll watch it, you know, it's decent, but it's none of them really stand out at the end of the day for me. I almost think it's like De Palma slumming in some ways.
Oh, I disagree.
Okay, no, I mean you could. I mean, I'm just saying to me, to me, De Palma will always be like Obsession and Blowout. Those are the films that we like. But I do think this is the material is beneath De Palma. I do believe.
Oh, I disagree completely.
Okay, that's cool, brother. That's cool. But
okay, well, let me disagree.
Okay,
it's a timely conversation since you guys are working on this show, all these shows about De Palma. But I think that's what's so great about De Palma is he can make things like Obsession and Sisters and Blowout. But he's also so great at making really, like, audience-friendly popcorn movies like Mission Impossible and Carrie. And I would say Mission to Mars and The Untouchables. You know, I think that's what's so interesting is about him is sometimes he actually can do both. And sometimes he doesn't either, like The Black Dahlia. So.
no, but I just really, I don't know, I just felt for him, like, and especially at that time, because what was the film before? It was Raising Cain, right?
Probably.
It's the one right before that, and that's just such a wild film and everything. And I understand. No, I mean, I just think, you know, it's not the first thing that comes to mind for me at least, to think of Mission Impossible. But, yeah, I mean, it's a decent film, but I do think there's, when De Palma does something really original, that to me is, you know, wow, for the most part. You know, it's really fascinating. But that's just, like, when I was really into De Palma, that it seemed like, wow, that's, you know, not something that I would really associate him with. But that's, like, 15, 20 years ago.
I will sort of agree with you that I'm not totally over the moon about the first movie, and I just don't really care at all about the second or third movie. I guess what I'm saying is, were it not for De Palma, I would feel the same way about the first movie as I do about the second and third.
Okay,
it
fair
would,
enough.
I'm in your boat. Because, what the hell am I saying, like Canadian all of a sudden? Because I think the thing that makes Mission Impossible work is the style of it. It is De Palma all the way. If anything, I think he's working overtime on that movie to give it whatever identity it has and personality it has.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a director for hire project. And somebody that we consider an auteur, those director for hire projects aren't as dear to our heart as the original stuff, like the Blowouts and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's true, but if you were in that movie theater in 96 or whatever it was when it happened, when it came out, and see that scene where Tom Cruise is rappelling into that CIA room, and they took the soundtrack off of the film. If you looked at the film, it had no soundtrack on it. It was completely silent, and the audience was completely silent. So a lot of times you can tell how into a movie an audience is by how silent they are in moments where they're supposed to be silent. And people were silent in that movie, and I would argue that that is a classic De Palma moment.
Filled
with suspense.
I agree. We do talk a little bit about Mission Impossible during the series next week. It actually comes up next week, Monday through Friday, every night at 10 p.m. Eastern. It is next week. Yeah. Starting on Labor Day, all leading up to De Palma's birthday. Speaking of De Palma, they're remaking Scarface.
Are they really? They've been talking about this for a while, but are they really doing it?
Well, this isn't a big studio thing. This is an Italian filmmaker. His name is Massimo Emilio Gabi, who's actually got a role in Gomorrah.
Oh,
and,
interesting.
He's filming a remake of Scarface. He's currently shooting. He's going to be shooting a little bit at a time. It's rumored. Guess who's rumored to be playing Elvira?
To be playing Elvira in the Scarface movie?
Yes.
Monica Bellucci is a good guess. Or how
Paris
about Paris
Hilton?
Holy shit! That was a wild guess.
That's it, man. Paris Hilton.
That's
wow.
crazy. Well, she's got the cocaine. Maybe she was rehearsing for her role this weekend.
Yeah, that was like method acting there.
That's right. You know her excuse for that? It wasn't my purse.
Yeah, and it wasn't her nose either.
Yeah. What a shame.
Yeah. Another one bites the dust.
And just all that money in those hands. That's just great.
Whatever. She'll be out, and she'll be rich for the rest of her life, no matter what we say. So
that's true.
Yeah. So speaking of somebody like Paris Hilton, Lindsay Lohan is getting good notices for Machete, which opens next weekend, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, does this movie have a limited appeal, given its built-in cult kind of status?
Absolutely, 100%.
I think Chris is right. I mean, this is a repeat. I love to be wrong, but I think this is a repeat of the Grindhouse weekend a couple of years ago, three and a half years ago.
If not worse.
I think this is a total, this is going to be like Scott Pilgrim all over again, I think, and maybe worse.
And that doesn't mean it's not going to be a fun movie.
Yeah,
Machete might be very, very good, but I just have a hard time believing people are going to want to go see that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The Drew Barrymore romance, and what's the other one?
The American.
The American, okay. A big, fat George Clooney assassin movie.
But that's not a sure thing either. I mean, we all know. We like Clooney. Clooney's having a hard time outside the Oceans movie getting a blockbuster, and that's what he's trying to do.
Well, if I'm being perfectly honest,
In terms of the weekend, I think it more people will see The American over the other two.
I don't know. If I'm being perfectly honest, The American has been very unappealing to me as far as the marketing campaign goes. I'm very underwhelmed by the movie and have almost little to no interest in seeing it.
Well, it screams a little artsy, is what the studios are fearing.
Yeah,
artsy doesn't go well with mainstream audiences.
What is this artsy crap?
Executive
saying that.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, Machete does not scream artsy. So.
No, I mean,
it is counter-programming. But that trailer to Machete, the extended unrated trailer, it's so outlandish that it makes me laugh. The whole swinging on the entrails thing to another window of the building, and it looks like a fun time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with everything. I mean, this film could do very well. It's going to depend on a lot of factors, but I mean, it could, compared to going the distance. I don't know if there's a demand for that.
I don't know how we're defining doing well with this movie too, because that's what Robert Rodriguez does. Is he makes really, really cheap movies, and they're typically very, very successful for that reason. I mean, they probably made this thing for like 300 pesos. So, if it makes that back, then we're going to see a sequel, at least direct to DVD.
Yeah,
which is basically what, $200 right now.
No, I understand what Chris said. He does do this. It's incredible. He does do things on the cheap, and this thing could actually, break even and actually make a profit. It depends. I mean, this is the thing. This is a whole thing that we've been talking about since the show started, really, almost, is that what we're seeing is the Comic-Con effect does not translate into full theaters. As horrible as that may be sounding, it just stuff that does well at Comic-Con is just a very small segment of the population.
Yeah,
and a very
it'll be a lot of. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, I'm not doubting the quality of the movie.
I might go see it. But Disney, one more financial thing. Disney is the first studio in history to have $2 billion grossers in the same year. And those two are?
I'm going to guess that those two are Toy Story 3 and, what's it called, Alice in Wonderland?
That's right. The rundown of the top earners in the history of worldwide cinema. Here they are. At number 7, Toy Story 3, which just passed a billion. Number 6 is The Dark Knight, $1.01 billion.
Wait, so Toy Story 3 is now number 1 worldwide of all time?
No, number 7.
Oh, sorry. I'm retarded.
It just passed a billion for a 7th place of all time.
Gotcha.
Worldwide. Alice in Wonderland, number 5, with $1.024 billion. Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, at number 4, $1.066 billion. Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, $1.119 billion in third place.
That's also the running time of that movie.
Number 2, Titanic, $1.8 billion. I can't even read these numbers. They're so astronomical.
Yeah.
Avatar, number 1, by a wide margin, $2.74 billion.
Wow.
It just strikes me, given the quality of the movie, Alice in Wonderland is the 5th biggest worldwide hit of all time.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels more like a ride than a movie. I found
yeah.
it very, very perplexing to sit through. I got to be honest. I found it downright fucking confusing. I was very, very lost shortly into that movie. I did not find it entertaining. I did not find it to be interesting. I didn't even find it to be very visually interesting. I actually thought it was kind of a mess, you know. I mean, it looked like a bunch of melted crayons or something like
yeah,
that.
I have to say, it might be the worst thing Tim Burton's ever done. It's just not really appealing at all, but when a movie like this makes a lot of money, we're going to see more movies like this from Tim Burton, so you can say, you know, I, for years, thought he should do Geek Love, which he would have been perfect for, but you're not going to get any Ed Woods or anything like that anymore. You're going to get Sleeping Beauty next, from what I understand. So.
Yeah. And I think there's, like, he's producing a Frankenweenie feature.
Yeah, a remake, yeah.
Well, there's no reason to do that, even. That's just, like, talk about scraping the bottom of the barrel. There's no reason to.
Yeah, I guess it's a feature, like, maybe something like a Henry Selznick kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Stop motion kind of.
Oh, Henry Selick? Henry?
What? Yeah.
Yeah, the guy who did James the Giant Peach and Nightmare Before Christmas, all those, yeah. I mean, that would be like David Lynch. I'm going to make Eraserhead 2, the sequel, you know, The Lonely Years or something. I mean, it's just, I mean, can you imagine David Lynch making a sequel or, like, Lost Highway 2?
I love it how you always put the subtitle, The Lonely Years, on everything.
Oh, it's an ongoing, it's a very...
I think that's hysterical, and I actually think that should be the title of the next Mission Impossible. Mission
Impossible
4, The Lonely Years.
But I mean, it's like, you know, we're seeing this from a lot of directors, and going back to, like, these rare... I mean, imagine if Coppola did, like, The Rain People 2, or Scorsese did, you know... What, you can imagine an old Scorsese film.
Who's that knocking at my door, too?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, why? Just the original's fine. Just put it out on another DVD or something. That's, you know, Frankenweenie, I don't think anyone wants to see a full feature. You'll destroy any integrity, I think, that the source material had, I think, when you do something.
Yeah, it's a great short film, and
yeah.
some things work best in short format.
Yeah.
But like,
you know,
like me.
Why don't more people do like what Soderbergh did with The Limey? Instead of going back and remaking a movie or making a direct sequel, you make sort of an offshoot, you know?
Yeah.
You make sort of a spin-off movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think that more people should do that because it worked so well. Maybe that's just Soderbergh. He's a really talented director. I think that's a better idea. I think that's more the angle people, you know, just take a character and do a sort of a spin-off movie. It doesn't even have to be a popular movie. If you just have all this love, I think that's what... A lot of it, from the filmmaker's point of view, from the studio, they want to make money. From the filmmaker's point of view, they really do love the original work, I think,
yeah.
in most of these cases. and they just want to sort of write a love song to these movies, and they end up just being indistinguishable from the original for the most part.
I agree. Donovan, I see that you've been on the line throughout the entire show. I'm going to pick up your call and continue the movie talk for a little bit after we premiere this theme from Dinner for Schmucks, which is now available, the soundtrack, for purchase on our webpage. Here's a theme for Dinner for Schmucks. Teddy Shapiro's theme for Dinner for Schmucks. You know what's interesting? That's a remake of a French film, right?
Mm-hmm.
The score sounds very French.
True. Well, they were originally going to use that for Predators.
That's good, Chris. All right. Hey, if anyone wants to see me in the newspaper with my Emmy picks, a friend just posted them on my Facebook page. So check it. I haven't even seen it yet, so I'll check that out when after I pick up this call from Donovan. Donovan.
Hey guys, movie geeks, what's up?
Hey, what's up, man?
I hope seeing that I was on hold and then you realize let's play Dinner for Schmucks. That was no indication of what you guys think of me.
No, not at all, Donovan. Never.
Yeah, it's all a. I played Predators for Chris and Dinner for Schmucks for you. And, I can't imagine whose line I'm going to pick up once I play Vampire Suck soundtrack.
Oh, God, let's not.
Oh, my God, I am so attractive in this newspaper. I'm sorry. You want to hear my Emmy picks for somebody that knows nothing about TV?
Sure.
You want to get that, Donovan? Best Actress Drama, I chose January Jones. I was the only one that did. Best Actor Drama, I picked John Hamm. Best Drama, I chose Lost. Because I think they'll give it to it as a kind of, this is your final year, you've made a real impact on TV, kind of a sentimental kind of thing. Don't you?
Yeah, I think, you're going on a lot of, you're giving them a lot of credit.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Lost.
I don't think they think that far into it, yeah.
Best Actress Comedy, The Chick from Glee. Leah Michelle,
mm-hmm.
that girl.
That girl.
That girl. Wasn't that like Sandy D or Sandra D?
No, not Sandy D. That was Phil Donahue's wife.
Marlo Thomas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Donovan.
Thank you.
Best Actor Comedy, Steve Carell. Best Comedy, Glee.
Hello?
Is that my other line? sorry about that. This happens. We have two lines in the house.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. I ruined the show for everyone.
Donovan, do you have any interest whatsoever in the Emmys?
I do. My favorite shows currently are Mad Men and Breaking Bad. So. So.
Wow.
I need to watch Breaking Bad. I just haven't gotten. I just don't have time. But I'd really love to get into that.
You really do. It's almost like, I mean, I don't know if anybody else has seen it here, but it's like, it's kind of Coen Brothers-esque sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, there's random bouts of violence just break out, but then there's like, it's very subtle, you know, and there's a lot of irony in it, so it's really good. Definitely check it out.
No, it
very
looks
cinematic.
It's a great premise. I mean, like with, you know, what Weeds, before I think Weeds jumped the shark, they're both great premises for the times we live in. Considering Weeds was done the last recession we had.
Yeah, Mary Louise Parker's never smoked pot. She tried a pot lollipop one time, but it had no effect.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an anecdote I read an interview the other day. Chris, and you missed the beginning of the show when I said the only thing great about the Emmys tonight, Chris, is that Pacino will win Best Actor. That's the only must-view kind of part of it for me.
I sure hope so. It's his best performance in quite a long time.
Yeah.
That will be really interesting, although I'm not going to sit through the entire Emmys show in order to see it. So
By the way, Pacino canceled his Evening with Al Pacino event. To be rescheduled for an undetermined date in 2011, and I knew it would happen, so I didn't buy tickets, because he's opening Merchant of Venice on Broadway on November 7th, and then the event was like November 16th. I was like, there's no way he can make that, so
mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to be a sucker.
You'll be a sucker in 2011. Yeah.
Too funny. Donovan, did you have anything in mind that you wanted to discuss?
I'd like to stay on a little bit longer and just talk about the movie news, but I did want to congratulate you. I listened to the James Cameron interview from Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think you guys did a great job. Are you getting enough recognition, like from the blogs or the internet people?
We've had a lot of support from our fans in the mm-hmm. social media. I mean, the thing was carried by, you know, a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, and we're grateful
I mean,
for that.
Really unexpected places. I mean, I saw people post stuff. I thanked someone for posting something on the University of Tampa Film Society website for us. I mean, you know, and the conservative blog that I mentioned earlier. They show up at the weirdest places, but we're appreciative of all of them.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed the interview, so kudos to you. Yeah.
Well, thank you, man. Thank you. And you sent me an email the other day where you had an idea for another game show.
Yeah.
And
What's that?
Tell us what that was. Share it with our co-host.
Then we're going to ruin it for the surprise. If you ever end up doing it.
we have different categories, and we have to tell people what the categories are before they can actually play them.
Oh, right. But this was like a different, other than the movie trivia, it was a different kind of, using a different medium.
Right.
All right, so what the fuck was it?
All right, if you don't want to give it away, I'll just throw it on someone right before they play it. But,
it had to do with audio commentary on DVDs and
that would be great.
Playing the directors or the cast member, and you know, getting a point for naming the movie that they're talking about, and then getting another point for the actual speaker, the director, or the cast member.
Right. I think that's a good idea. I think we're going to have this really diverse kind of movie trivia setup from now on. Okay, Chris, we've talked about this before, but you know, it's been so long since I've listened to director commentaries on DVDs.
You don't listen to them anymore?
No, not usually. Not that I don't enjoy them, but I'll watch the DVD once and then I have to return it, and I don't have time to watch it again with the director commentary. But I did. They sent me three copies of the film That Evening Sun, the Hal Holbrook film.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea why I have three copies of it, but I did listen to the director commentary on that. But the best director commentary is actually, I'll ask Donovan before we let him go to get your take on what the best directors are for commentaries.
Oh, I wasn't prepared, but let me see. I remember a long time ago when I was listening to the Oliver Stone Arnold Schwarzenegger commentary for Conan the Barbarian.
They both did commentary on it?
Yeah, and you guys have to check it out because it sounds like they're imbibing, like they're drinking. Like,
oh, I'm sure.
Video. They sound pretty tipsy. It's really funny. It's a really funny. That was like 10 years ago. I listened to that. So
mm-hmm. They're in the same room together.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, it was. I wonder if it's out of print at this point. Does Jerry own it?
I have it, but I mean, I got to be honest with you. I'm not a big commentary buff. I'm not really. Mm. I mean, it's just I got to be honest with you. I don't listen to that many commentaries. It's just, you know, after a while, it's just like, yeah, well, you know, that's cool. Some of the, some of the big, like for Coppola, I've listened to a couple of commentaries and others, but I got to be honest with you, I'm not the biggest commentary person out there.
Oliver Stone does great commentaries, though.
Yes, he does.
I like it.
Oh, my God. It's like a weird old hippie strolling down memory lane every time you get him. And I'm convinced that he does indeed drink or smoke a joint or maybe even take a hit of acid before he does his commentary. That guy gets emotional.
Yeah, he does.
He is all over the place, and that makes him one of my favorite commentators.
You can hear him drinking in Platoon, the Platoon commentary.
Yeah, I think they're fairly open about it during that one.
The other person you can hear drinking during a commentary, even though he's drinking a milkshake, is Jack Lemmon in the Glengarry Glen Ross commentary.
Oh, wow.
Which is great. That's a great commentary.
I thought you were going to say Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were going there, too. So
he does commentary, and then Jamie Foley does commentary on a separate track. But it's such a treasure to hear Jack Lemmon talk about, you mm-hmm. know, one of his last great roles. I mean, he was phenomenal in that movie, and paired up with actors that were worthy of him. You know,
Al Pacino being one of them.
Yeah.
God, I love that movie. It's been a while since I've seen it.
I have to revisit that. I know I own it, but it's still in the shrink wrapper.
Yeah, I have many like that. Yep.
It surprises me. It surprises me that you guys are not more into commentaries. That really surprises me. The thing about commentaries for me is I'll listen to somebody do commentary, and if they just aren't very good at it, I think it's a skill, really.
It is.
And some directors, while they're great directors, are not particularly great at it. And also, there's sort of different styles of commentary. You get a guy like Oliver Stone or a guy like Francis Ford Coppola, they get very emotional. They sort of talk about the mood on set, and they really just sort of tell anecdotes and stories about filming. And that can be really interesting. Those two guys are very good at that. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, you can get a guy like Steven Soderbergh, who goes very detailed about the filmmaking process. And Chris Nolan does this too.
Mm-hmm.
Very detailed about the filmmaking process. And it's almost like a film school, really. Like, tells exactly what kind of stock film they use, how they set the angles up, what time of day they use, like everything, you know, from beginning to end, how you make a movie. Or how you make that particular movie. Those guys are some of the best.
The Soderbergh-Cameron on Solaris.
Soderbergh-Cameron is one of the best commentaries ever made because you kind of get the best of both worlds because Cameron is a great storyteller too. And he actually starts to that's one of the best commentaries ever done. And then you can get something like the Kevin Smith commentaries, which are like parties. And if you're a fan of those movies and if you're a fan of those actors, mm-hmm. it's almost like watching another movie. Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau commentary on Maid is very similar. It's almost like another movie that I can watch. You know, it's one of the funniest commentaries ever made. It's almost funnier than the movie.
Well, I do every time I have a chance. I listen to the commentary on the DVD. I enjoy it as much as you do. I just find that I have less and less of a chance to because I don't rent a lot now. Everything that gets mailed to me that has a commentary on it, I listen to.
Remember watching the As Good As It Gets commentary and how totally unintelligible Jack Nicholson was on it?
Like
he's speaking another language.
Weren't you and I watching that together?
Yes, that's what I mean. We watched it together, and it was completely, like, you can't understand anything he's saying. And when you do understand what he's saying, it's completely apropos of nothing and absolutely inappropriate for the conversation.
You know that he's speaking English. You understand the words. They just don't go together.
Oh, there's a lot of treasures like that, and I've often thought that we should do special movie geek awards each year, and that best commentary would be a great category for.
Oh, that's a great idea, man. No, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I think we that would be an excellent category. Yeah, I think we should. I think we should develop specific. I mean, we can do all the standard categories because on our show, it's not going to be 3.5 hours long. We can sort of rush through them.
Yeah.
We can have more interesting categories.
You don't
like
want a musical number in between it?
No, I don't. Not unless Jerry's singing it, in which case I will accept.
Yeah.
No, you don't. You want people to keep tuning into the show.
I think that's a great idea. We can go get some trophies made. We can mail them out to the
publicists there you go.
Of the winners. Seriously,
yeah.
That's a great idea, man.
Yeah,
God.
Geeky.
All right.
And you might get some celebrities to actually call in too to accept their award.
That's true. We could do that.
That'd be good.
Sandra Bullock,
but then that would kind of be like. We'll only give the award to somebody that calls in and accepts it. Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, like we can get some. We'll get some celebrities. Enough of this James Cameron bullshit.
Yeah, it's about time we get some famous people on.
Yeah, really.
Well, we're working on. I don't know how successful we'll be. We're working on a 30th anniversary celebration of Empire Strikes Back.
Maybe get Irvin Kershner on.
Yeah, that's not happening. I think we got Chewbacca. Peter Mayhew. Yeah, but I sent out to all the Star Wars people for it. And then Apocalypse Now is coming out in this Uber Blu-ray edition.
Mm-hmm.
And
they've really been milking that one, haven't they?
I guess a new studio
between the two that we just mentioned, yeah.
Lionsgate bought it. And so they're releasing it, both cuts and the Hearts of Darkness. So we'll see about Martin Sheen kind of answer to that. So we'll see. I mean, some exciting things might be upcoming on the show. The controversy with the Apocalypse Now is that Hearts of Darkness is included in it, which is just a superlative documentary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's directed by George Hickenlooper.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And essentially, Coppola has just wiped out his involvement in the documentary altogether and just credited his wife with the film. Hickenlooper's really kind of ticked off and has gone to the press and made his argument public that this was his big break in the business. He admires the hell out of Coppola, but it's his film. I mean, utilizing footage that Eleanor Coppola shot and everything, but he put it together and rounded up the new interviews, and it's his film.
Right.
He's arguing. So it's a great film, and it's great that it'll be available on Blu-ray in this box set.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the definitive making of a hellacious production, the most hellacious production ever.
But it's not going to be, it's not some re-edited Hearts of Darkness. It's not some truncated version.
I don't think it is, no.
Well, I mean, that's the only reason I can think that he would be able to get away legally with doing that, with cutting someone out like that. Otherwise, I would think that there would be legal repercussions down the road. Maybe that's what we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, well, Eleanor Coppola also wrote the book.
Notes.
Yeah. I think prior to the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, a lot of the property is hers, you could argue. I mean, she's one of the main – she's the person that put the footage on film.
Yeah. Yeah, but he either did – Hickenlooper either did or did not make the movie. You can't put the movie back.
You can't have this revisionist history.
Yeah.
I mean, and he did a good job – and he's a good filmmaker to boot, as it is. So I don't know why Coppola would go ahead and do this. I don't understand this.
I submitted to him too, so maybe we can ask him if he comes back for it. But Hickenlooper's new film, actually, he has one coming out later this year, the Casino Jack film with Kevin Spacey. Yeah. Okay, Donovan, thank you for hanging in with us. Did you want to bring up anything else before I let you go, or?
No, that's cool. I'm glad I get to talk to you guys.
And likewise. Have a great night, man.
All right. You too. Enjoy the Emmys, and let's root for Al Pacino.
Okay,
that's
cool.
That's right.
Donovan knows what's, you know, knows what's out of his bread is butter. There you go.
That's right. I was just about to say that. Thank you for calling in and sucking up, Donovan.
Really.
It works, man.
Yeah, that's how you pick up. You answer my, you reply to my emails if I just keep pushing that Al Pacino envelope.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you, buddy.
Okay, take care.
All right.
Bye-bye, man. Chris, you saw, speaking of DVDs, you saw something unique that you shared with me last week. You saw the Insomnia Blu-ray, which is structured a unique way, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I don't know if it's unique to the Blu-ray. I don't know, the DVD might be like that, too. I never owned it on DVD, but I did buy the Insomnia Blu-ray, and it's got the commentary that I was referring to just a couple minutes ago by Chris Nolan. And it is structured in order of shooting sequence. He does comment, you know, I mean, the movie is structured just like you saw in the theater, but the commentary is re-edited to be shown in the order that it was shot, which is, it's always been, not always, but over the years, that movie, when I first saw it, I wasn't totally crazy about it, I got to be honest. And it's one of those movies that I've sort of revisited and liked a little bit more each time I saw it. Now I like it very much. But when you watch it in that order, Pacino's performance in the original movie never really stuck out to me. Just sort of seemed like a good Pacino performance, but not his best. And watching it in the order of that it was shot really makes you appreciate his performance 10 times more. Because there is a serious arc to his character throughout that movie, just in terms of exhaustion. And the way he looks physically, and he didn't do that in order at all. In fact, it was all over the place. But he was somehow, as an actor, I guess, able, I don't know, he had notes in his own script or something. He was able to know what sort of tone Will Dormer was in for each shot. And watching it out of sequence, it's really easy to tell that he's all over the place. When you watch the movie, it's sort of seamless that he's sort of entropy of his mental state, but watching it in the shooting sequence, it's amazing, totally amazing that he was able to do that. And I really don't think a lot of people appreciate it like they should.
Well, you know that I do. I mean, I'd love to see it the way that you saw it, but I was definitely amazed by the degradation of the character. And then I read Chris Nolan talking about how much it was out of sequence, and there are very specific conversations about what stage Dormer's at here and there. It's an amazingly physical performance that he gives in that movie, not only underappreciated, but kind of underplayed. It's another great underplayed performance from him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what people complain about Pacino in the last couple of years is him, you know, oh, every movie he's just screaming and all this kind of stuff. Well, there really isn't much of that in this movie. He's a very quiet guy, Will Dormer. There's a couple times where he loses his temper, but it's very quick. Almost instant. It's a different kind of performance for Pacino, and a good one. So,
kind of akin to the brooding Godfather 2. And he just had those two episodes in Godfather 2 where he's two or three when he starts screaming.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him screaming, saying. In my home, in my bedroom, where my wife sleeps, and then asking Robert Duvall to give him a straight answer about the baby or something, and then
the
screaming
Diane
at
Keaton.
And slapping her, which is, that's a volcanic intensity right there that he showed in that scene. I'll have to check that out. I'll come over tonight and watch it with you. That's a threat. All right, Dean is on the line. He's been on the line for a while, so I'm going to take it, and we'll see what he has to say. Dean?
Hey, what's up? Hey, what's up, man? Let's see. I was going to bring the commentary thing back into play and give you three or four really great commentaries that can pop into my mind.
Okay, we got 5 minutes.
I really like the Spinal Tap commentary that was done with all of the guys in character commenting on the documentary Spinal Tap. I like it when they do something different with commentary. So in that respect, I also liked the fake commentary done for Blood Simple a few years ago, where it had like the fake producer of Blood Simple on, like. sort of spoofing commentaries in general. I thought that was extremely funny. When filmmakers do it, I hate the commentaries that kind of just kind of go over what's going on screen. Like I really remember on this thing, William Friedkin doing the Exorcist commentary, and he was just telling what was happening like in front of our eyes, and that's not
Chris,
a good commentary.
Do you know about that Friedkin commentary?
No, I've never heard it. Although it sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. Let's see. I really like also commentaries that are done by film writers, film experts.
Yes. Yeah.
So, like, for instance, all of the commentaries that were done for all of the Val Lewton movies that came out a few years ago. Like Curse of the Cat People and all that kind of stuff. All of those commentaries are done, and a lot of film noir commentaries are done by writers.
Right.
I like those too because they seem to be worked out quite well beforehand. There's no extemporaneous kind of thing. It's almost like they wrote it out and they're on there.
Well, yeah. And Criterion's great for that too because they always kind of use film professors and things for a lot of their stuff. Like a guest of ours that died this year, unfortunately, what's his name? Peter, he talked about Antonioni with us.
Oh, that's
he's,
right.
He's a professor. He did a lot of the Fellini stuff for Criterion. And there's also great, you know, I watched Citizen Kane I don't know how many times, but then I watch it with Roger Ebert's commentary, which
exactly.
is kind of a scene-by-scene play on what you should be looking for in this scene and that scene, and it was completely illuminating for me because I am not one that grasps the full meaning or the craft of a movie just the first time seeing it. I'm not bright enough to just come up with something clever right away about a lot of movies. Those commentaries are extremely helpful to me. I can just steal their insights.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Ebert does a couple of commentaries. I think he does Casablanca and Dark City also. He's really good at it. Another great commentary, a guy who's awesome at it, although he's usually annoying, and I wish he'd do more commentaries, is Quentin Tarantino. He does a commentary on the True Romance DVD, as speaking just as the writer. And it's really, really fascinating and really, really interesting. And I swear to God, the guy must have done at least an 8-ball of cocaine throughout the entire commentary. Because, I mean, he's just going 1,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was really doing cocaine or if that's just Tarantino, but it's a
great
commentary.
I think that's just Tarantino, though.
Yeah, maybe.
That's him.
Spike Lee, not interesting commentary, surprisingly.
No,
yeah.
Awful. Oh,
I was surprised
awful.
By that, too. I was surprised by that, too. On the Do the Right Thing.
George P. Cosmatos, Cobra.
Well, I was going to bring that up because Dean said he doesn't like the commentaries where they tell you exactly what's happening on screen. Rick and I, who is in the chat room now, his screen name is Anaconda Was Funny, which is the greatest screen name ever beside Kitten Fist, of course. We used to watch the commentary on Cobra constantly. George P. Cosmatos, he tells you, like, his commentary goes like, he gets out of his car, you see the boot, you look up, there are birds flying off the telephone wire, he walks into the supermarket, he shoots his gun, I mean, that's what the commentary is. And what's great about Cosmatos, and I know that I probably brought this up before, but he's made, let's see, he's made one great movie, which was intentionally great, Tombstone. I think Cobra's a great movie because of how bad it is. But and Tombstone's the last DVD he does. It's like an afterthought. He says, I'll do special edition Leviathan. I'll do special edition Cobra. I've got Tombstone, too. Okay, throw that in there. But his one regret about Cobra, the one thing that he regrets most about the way he did Cobra, was he didn't use enough dry ice in the grocery store.
I think that's a very honest thing to say. I just love that, you know, because I know that scene. I remember that scene perfectly.
Yeah. Which just goes to show you what they say is true. A director is the last person you should consult about the value of their work.
Never, I'll never look at dry ice the same way ever again.
Well, talking about that point, one of my very favorite commentaries was done by the recently deceased Ronald Neame on Poseidon Adventure, on the special edition of Poseidon Adventure. And I like that commentary particularly because he's very honest all the way down the line about what's good about the movie and what's bad about it. He always points out, oh, maybe Gene Hackman overplayed this scene a little bit. I wish I would have pulled back on him. But he's also very, like, he talks about, you know, his valued extras in the capsizing of the ship scene and how great they all were and talks about individual stunt people and so forth and so on. He gets very detailed in what he likes and dislikes about the movie, and also how surprised he was that the movie turned out to be such a success.
We all were.
As a kid, I thought that was the greatest movie I'd ever seen.
It paved the way for Gene Hackman to be in Superman, because he was obviously very strong to carry Shelley Winters like he did in that movie. Thank you, man, for calling in, Dean. We're going
to
end
the
show.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye.
Go ahead, Chris. What?
All right, brings up an interesting question about commentaries, because there's some directors who just flat out refuse to do them. And there are all sorts of different directors, like Steven Spielberg, Woody Allen, David Lynch. I mean, you can sort of understand it in David Lynch's case. Wouldn't it be interesting to hear a Steven Spielberg commentary or a Woody Allen commentary? Talk about somebody crapping on his own work.
Think of all those films that he doesn't like of his that we all like.
Yeah, and what would be interesting would... Yeah, it's not like he'd just be crapping on Curse of the Jade Scorpion. He would be crapping on movies like Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he hates that one or not, but, you know, movies that we like that he does not, like Husbands and Wives, for instance. He probably doesn't like that movie very much.
Right.
I would love to hear that. I would love to hear Spielberg. I mean, I feel like he would be very, very good at it. I would like to know why he does not do it. You know, Paul Thomas Anderson's another one. God, I'd love to hear a commentary on There Will
Be
Blood. How great would
that would be a very interesting commentary to hear from him on all five.
Spielberg would be like golden, though. I mean, to hear his insights. And nobody knows framing better than he does. No, you know, for as one example of things that he could illuminate on.
Yeah.
And man, who else has a greater library that somebody would be interested in hearing details about?
My God! Like hearing him go over some of just not even famous movies, but famous shots and famous moments, and you know, it's really just sort of culturally iconic moments that he could, you know, talk about, and it would be so fascinating. I don't know why he doesn't do it. I don't know if he's ever talked about it, but he just doesn't do it. Flat out doesn't. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't have to.
You know what else I love? I love when, and this might be something for Spielberg to consider too, I love it when other directors, not the ones that directed the movie, do the commentary for the movie. Like, Soderbergh did it with Point Blank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which has been talked about, the editing style and so forth, as influential for the limey and out of sight kind of thing.
Well, there's a lot of truth, definitely in the case of the limey, for sure.
Yeah, and that seduction scene and out of sight. And
mm-hmm.
You know, and so, and that's brilliant. I love hearing other directors appreciate the work of their contemporaries, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Tarantino does a lot of that in the True Romance commentary. You know, I mean, he's a fan of Tony Scott, of course, we all know that. And then Cameron with Soderbergh in the Solaris commentary. I do agree. It would be a lot more interesting. It would be interesting to hear Tarantino do a commentary on Dressed to Kill or something like that,
or Blowout would be the ultimate.
Or Blowout.
Yeah.
And the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly too.
Yeah, Steven Spielberg doing a commentary on a John Ford movie or something like that would be very, very interesting, you know, because those are the movies that shape them as filmmakers. You know, they know them backwards and forwards.
Right.
They know those movies. Tarantino probably knows Blowout better than you know it, Jerry. You know, I mean, he probably knows that movie backwards.
Oh, he knows. I mean, he would know that. But I think actually The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, because The Good and the Bad and the Ugly is his all-time favorite film. I would love to hear that. Or now, let me ask you this. Is there, I don't know, I don't have it near me, Does Lucas do commentary on the Criterion Hidden Fortress? I think he might be involved in that somehow.
Yeah, I think maybe he does.
Mm-hmm.
His affection for Kurosawa.
Mm-hmm.
That would be interesting, yeah. Except for it's George Lucas, and he's terribly
wrong. Oh, yeah, let me ask, I will say this. The worst one of the worst commentaries.
We get in so
is,
much trouble for...
Yeah, we're not going to say it. We're not saying anything. There you go.
What?
Chris isn't aware.
Don't go there, Chris, please. Not tonight.
What were you about to say, Jerry?
No. It's just, I'd be curious to hear that. But I think Chris has a very good point. It would be great to hear a lot of these directors or the films that they were influenced by. First of all, it'd be great for the studios because they can milk the, make more money. But it would be, I think, a really nice thing to have to hear some of these directors talk about the films that shaped them.
Yeah, I agree. So there's our DVD commentary conversation.
I like how you're framing all this, Jamie, tonight.
I know. Well, I have to close it somehow.
Right.
We're going to close the show, actually, with the score, one of the themes for the new movie, Vampires Suck. It's not called Vampire Sucks. It's called Vampires Suck. That's right. It's composed by Christopher Lennertz, who's a great guy, who we've had on the show before, and we're thinking of putting him in the next installment of Name That Film Score. By the way, I talked to Austin yesterday, and Austin Wintory, a great composer who participated in our last Name That Film Score, and he'll be back for this next one. He guess where he went last night with Amin? Okay.
Where'd he go?
He went to the John Williams concert at the Hollywood
I knew
Bowl.
It. Okay, I knew. Okay, yeah.
How amazing would that have to be? Okay. I love the silences. I never know how to react to this. I mean, that would be great. I mean, just
no, it would be. It would be great. Yeah.
Evening of film music at the Hollywood Bowl.
At the Hollywood Bowl, especially. Forget what it was. Just to be there.
He said the highlight of the night was John Williams, I guess, played a score from Sabrina, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's got such a wealth of material.
Oh, he's got an incredible, there's just so much to choose from. This was all of his music, though, not just a single film series. This was everything, right?
Yeah, I'm sure it was just a compilation of, I'm sure, his most popular themes, the Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Harry Potter and the little oddities here and there, like Sabrina. Mm-hmm. You know, I always liked Accidental Tourist, and I doubt he played that. That's not really a concert hall piece, but, it has to be suited for that kind of environment. And Austin also... offered, Jerry, I told you before the show, he also offered to redo our opening theme.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. That's great.
So we got a new opening theme coming, guys. How's that feel, Chris?
Feels great.
I'm very pleased about it, although I do think that you should do a retro show once where you do the original theme that we used to play.
The 30s year porn theme.
The porn music?
Yeah, the 30s porn music, yeah. Just bring that back.
I don't know if I still have that.
Well, you were the only one that would have had it. I don't know if anyone else is going to be able to get it for you.
I'm answering your question now, Chris. We can talk about that, but we get lots of hate mail.
Really?
Yeah, people threatening not to listen to the show ever again if we bring it up.
I mean, we really just got to...
If we bring up what specifically?
Anything bad or derogatory about it. I know that the people listening don't have any idea what we're talking about, but...
There's one person who does, and I just don't want to... I even seen the comment now, so, I mean...
Yeah.
So...
I got a problem with that, but okay. We can...
Dude, well, we did talk about it for several shows. It didn't stop us, but we don't want every single show to include something... And it seems like, for whatever reason, it's irony, but that's been happening lately.
Right, yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, here, I'll say this. I love the Star Wars movies, and there are moments I love in the new Star Wars movies. But and I find George Lucas to be an interesting filmmaker, and at certain points in his career to be a very good filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
But having seen him in interviews, I do not find him interesting to listen to. As much as I like his movies, some of them, I do not find him interesting to listen to. A little
right.
bit, I don't know, a little bit esoteric in his own world.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I meant. So.
Right.
Nothing against George Lucas. I'm not a hater. I'm not one of these people that hates George Lucas.
No, there's no reason to.
You're not one of those guys that feels like he raped your childhood.
I don't even understand that line. I never even understood how people could...
I know. I remember that whole thing, George Lucas raped my childhood. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Those are people
that still
sleep in the bed sheets.
I mean, none of us hate him. It's just that some of us were disappointed in the newer films. But I think Chris said it really well. There are moments in the new ones that are good. And it's just that we're disappointed that the whole couldn't work out as well as some of those scenes.
Okay. Well, I look forward to the mail I'll receive after tonight.
Oh, God. Please let me know about it.
I think people are taking it too seriously.
Yeah, you're taking yourself a little bit too seriously. Probably ought to back away from the computer, back away from the TV, back away from your penis, and go out into the real world.
Back away from Doritos.
Go out into the real world, get yourself a job and a family, and call it a life.
Right. James Cameron's the worst movie maker ever.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Ironically, it's probably the same person.
Yeah.
It might very well be.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Future shows, we've got the De Palma series all next week, every night. 10 p.m. Eastern, Sisters, Carrie, Dress to Kill, Blowout, Raising Kane, Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. Eastern. Guests like the producers Edward R. Pressman, who did Sisters. He also has The New Wall Street coming out. George Lido, who produced Dress to Kill and Blowout. Actors Keith Gordon, Nancy Allen. There's an interview you guys want to hear.
Nancy Allen. You definitely want to hear that.
Yeah. And author and critic John Kenneth Muir, which is probably the best film analysis we've ever featured on this program, contained in these De Palma shows with John. And additional insights from Armand White and Vilmos Zsigmond. So this is going to be a great series of shows. And also editor Paul Hirsch, who edited all of De Palma's thrillers for the most part. And also did a little movie called Star Wars, and Empire Strikes Back.
Wow.
And Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Oh, those suck. Yeah, those are just garbage, man.
Which I rewatched, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and I was thinking of Paul Hirsch the whole time I was watching it. So that's next week. Wednesday night we do our fall movie preview between the three of us, where we'll talk about every kind of major release and some gems in there and give our take on them. And our expectations. And then the following Wednesday, I think the 15th, Name That Film Score. And throughout the month, we have people like the writer-director Nicholas Meyer, who did Star Trek II. He wrote Star Trek IV. He did Star Trek VI. You know, he's
time after time.
Time after time. The day after. The day after.
I think the
biggest television event in history, actually. I think like 100 million people watched that worldwide. I've been wanting to watch that again lately. But so he's a great guest, and he has a new book, The View from the Bridge. It was actually released in hardcover last year, releases in paperback this month,
mm-hmm.
recounting his amazing career pre, during, and post Star Trek, which I guess that's how he divides up his professional life.
No, he's an interesting guy. Didn't he also do the 7% Solution?
That was his first movie that he got off the ground, yeah. And I remember him saying in the book, he talks about Robert Duvall because he was with the director. I forget who directed it. It wasn't Herbert Ross. It was somebody else. The Arthur Hiller, maybe?
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not near anything to look it up. But
the guy that came out in the Oscars every year about 10 years ago with a bad suit, Arthur Hiller.
That's Arthur Hiller. Yeah, talk
yeah,
with his
that's
hand.
Arthur Hiller. but he was talking about watching Robert Duvall act, and they thought he was terrible. And then Robert Duvall was like, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And they said, "Well, express something, you know, be bigger." But then they watched him in the dailies, and they saw that it was all there. And Dennis Hopper said exactly the same thing when he directed him in Colors. He said, you look through the lens, Duvall's not doing anything, and you're thinking, is he going to act sometime soon? But it is all there the second you watch the dailies. He has he's had it from the beginning.
I forgot to tell you guys, I saw Get Low this weekend. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Oh, how'd you see it? Well, don't tell
me. It's playing over in Tampa. No,
okay.
I went to the movie theater and saw it.
Duvall was great in that movie, that closing monologue.
Yeah, believe it or not, somebody, it was really funny, somebody in the movie theater got up and took a piss during that monologue. Not in the theater. They left the theater to go to the bathroom. But it's weird because has there ever been a movie where you were waiting for one thing to happen and you knew you were waiting for that one thing to happen the entire movie? Like for 2 hours they're talking about, well, we're going to have this party and he's going to get up and talk about what happened. And he gets up and starts talking about what happened, and this guy feels like this is the perfect time to go take a piss.
That's got to be the worst time to leave ever. I mean,
yeah,
wow.
I mean, it's really bizarre, really bizarre. But back to the movie, Robert Duvall is so likable and so lovely. And the movie's, you know, the movie's sort of made in sort of a workman-like way. You know, it's a very, it's a solid job, but I do wish it had more of an artistic flourish to it.
It's an unassuming, folksy kind of.
Yeah,
approach.
It's made
very folksy,
it's made
yeah.
like one of his wooden tables or his wooden coffin. Like it's just nothing more, nothing less. But the performances from him and from Bill Murray are memorable. And
yes, they are.
Movie.
Yeah, and that monologue, man, one take, and that's those are the kind of moments I wait for because you could tell that was a surprise to him. That you're seeing a moment. It's not manufactured. It you're seeing it as it happens, you know?
Yeah, but it works. It's not garbage.
Yeah.
It really works,
right.
And it seems genuine to that character. It seems like, I mean, the guy's a little bit crazy, you know? And it just seems so, so genuine and really, really memorable performance. I mean, I was glad to see it. Well, Duvall's always great, but if only we could get those kind of performances from Dustin Hoffman, you know, from these guys that sort of feel like they're slumming it lately, from Robert De Niro. If only we could get one of those kind of performances. I think it's the odds-on favorite, personally, for Best Actor at the Oscars this year.
I do, too. I do, too. All right, let's close the show with Vampires Suck.
All right, yeah, what a way to go from Duvall to this, yes.
What a segue.
Yes.
All right, guys. I'll see you all Wednesday night. I'm looking forward to it, guys.
All right, cool. Good night, everyone.
See ya.
Good night.